Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. I wanted to talk about the Bulls because I found the Joakim Noah injury so interesting, and the best person to talk to for me is Sean Hyken, who covers the Bulls for Bleacher Report, and he also covers the NBA for Pro Basketball Talk. And so we start with the Bulls, talk about that for a while, and then we also get into some other issues, cover media stuff, also All-Star Weekend, and, you know, Sean and I have known each other for a little while, so we get into some other topics. If you want to see timestamps, I'm going to have them. They'll be in the notes for this podcast. They will also be on the website. So if you want to hear when we talk about something specific, take a look there. The whole conversation runs a little over an hour. So I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk to you about the Bulls because I feel like this next couple weeks is a really fascinating and important window for this team. And Noah's injury has, to me at least, and it'll be interesting to see what you say, has really kind of changed how this is going to function.
It really has, because, you know, over the last couple of weeks before the injury, there had kind of been this talk that, you know, this is not really a team that makes a lot of trades, but, like, they've, you know, you hear they've been shopping Noah, they've been shopping Taj Gibson, they've maybe been shopping Pau Gasol, who the front office doesn't really want to trade, but at this point they might not have a choice, just because they have such a logjam. And then when Noah goes down basically for the whole season, they haven't officially ruled him out for the season yet, but, I mean, 4 to 6 months, so, you know, basically he's out for the season. Now they kind of can't afford to do anything. And now, you know, suddenly Bobby Portis, who has been pretty inconsistent, has to play a lot of minutes. And it just changes everything.
Yeah, and as you said, there was this idea that they had to move something. And part of what makes the Bulls so compelling to me as a cap nerd is that they have this complicated spot where they have a lot of existing salary that they're not going to move. You know, Derrick Rose, Jimmy Butler, probably Mirotic and Dunleavy. What that means is that they have Noah and Gasol are both on contracts that can't expire. Noah's does and Gasol's can, and with an opt-out that I think we all expect that he will use.
Yeah.
So they either need to, for the ones they want to bring back, they either need to expect that they're going to do that, or they should probably trade them, except for the whole they're trying to be competitive this year aspect of it. So they have this, I kind of call it a three-dimensional chess situation, because you have to be thinking about these multiple goals at the same time.
See, yeah, that's the thing. Like, they're not going to trade any of these guys just to trade them. Like, the last time they really did that was a couple of years ago when they traded Luol Deng, basically, for Andrew Bynum's contract, which they immediately waived, and then a couple of future picks. But that was a different thing because they knew they weren't going to re-sign him. They wanted to get under the luxury tax. They wanted to clear cap space to make a run at Carmelo Anthony, and Derrick Rose was out for the year, so they weren't really going to be a title contender that year anyway. Not that I think this team is going to be a title contender, but I think they think they are. So in this case, like, you can trade Pau Gasol, but what are you getting for Pau Gasol at this point? He's 35. He's not having as good a year as he did last year, but he's, you know, you can still talk yourself into him being, like, a difference maker for a contender, but, like, you know, 35 years old and can opt out and will opt out. Like, what are you getting back for him that's going to help you win now? I'm looking around. I can't really see any trades that are out there.
And another big complication with Gasol is that in another year, you could have the benefit of, so this gets a little bit wonky, but I think it's important to have out there, is that, right, if he opts out this year, whoever has him at the end of it will have his early bird rights, which means that you can't sign him to whatever contract and go over the cap, but you can sign him to a decent pay raise to go over. And so in another year, that would be a really nice thing for a team that, let's say, was pushing on it, actually kind of like the Bulls, where it'd be like, well, we probably couldn't sign him outright, but if we have him, then we can probably re-sign him. But this year, so many teams are going to have cap space that the group of franchises that will benefit from that is so minimal that you can't really make a market out of that.
Right. It's not like there's going to be any teams that aren't going to have the cap space you're going to need. Like, what do you think he's going to be getting on the open market at this point? He's making around 7 or 8 this year, and then next year if he opts in, but he's not going to opt in. So he's making around 7 this year. I think with the new cap, he could probably easily get, you know, 10, maybe even 15 on, like, a short-term deal, like a 3-year, $45 million deal or something.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a choice of what he wants, whether he wants a shorter deal in the, like, yeah, $14 to $15 million range, or he wants, let's say, like, four for 40 or something like that. Like, if he wants to go longer, because he's at the age where if you sign him to a four-year contract, you know you're getting a lot of downside.
I would not want to give Pau Gasol a four-year deal in 2016.
Yeah, I agree. And so, yeah, there are a couple of guys like that in this class that I think if they want to go short-term, I would actually probably recommend it if it's the right team. You know, if for whatever reason a team just doesn't have enough space and that's how they can do it. But if I'm Powell, like, you've done as much as he's done in the league, if he wants to, I would just try to find the best overall situation. And if he already left, I believe he left a little bit of money on the table to go to the Bulls, worked out reasonably well, mm-hmm. and he can do that again, whether that's with Chicago or someone else.
I think he will not be back with the Bulls next year. I can say that pretty confidently.
So do I, and that's the other reason why I'd consider trading him is just, you know, but at the same time, now without Noah, you don't have the same kind of fail-safe fallback as you did before, just because if you trade him, it's very unlikely that you're going to be that real second-tier Eastern Conference contender.
Right, and then, you know, if you get rid of Pau, you have one healthy, you know, proven veteran big at that point, which is Taj Gibson. Mirotić has been inconsistent. Bobby Portis, we still don't really know what he is, and I think he's going to be a good player in the long term, and we'll probably talk about him a little bit later. But right now, I don't think he's really ready to, you know, play the kind of minutes that would be expected of him if they traded Gasol in addition to not having Noah for the rest of the year. So they just don't really have the option because, you know, at this point, Taj Gibson is their only real, you know, consistent big who actually has been there before and knows what he's doing.
And beyond that, they have the issue that if theoretically they're moving on from Noah and Gasol, which is a possibility but not necessarily definite.
I think it's pretty likely.
Yeah, so then you're losing both of your natural centers. Gasol's not the greatest rim protector anymore. Actually, never was before. Noah has had his limitations, but you have three guys who I think we like all three of them, but none of them are natural centers, which means that you're either going to play them in weird combinations or you're going to need somebody else, and it's not like they're going to have the ability to replace them easily. So they're in a tight spot. I fully believe that they can figure their way out, but it's going to be hard.
Yeah, and I don't really know what they're going to be able to do in terms of adding a big man. I mean, obviously the guy that's going to be available this summer that's, you know, what the best big available is going to be Al Horford, but they're not going to have I don't know why Al Horford would come to Chicago, and B, they're not going to have the cap space to sign him anyway. So
yeah, exactly. And so Horford, you know, Horford's the pipe dream, and I mean there's the possibility that, you know, I don't know how his relationship with Noah is now,
but they're really tight still.
So, I mean, that you would think of that as an advantage for Chicago, except that the only way they can bring in Horford would be to lose Noah, unless Noah decides, like, oh, I'm going to be nice and take the minimum. But
which, I mean, yeah, you have to think, and I wrote a column about this yesterday, actually, after Noah talked to the media for the first time since his surgery. You know, the only way he's going to be back with the Bulls is if he wants to take a pay cut, and I really just don't see him doing that, because if you look at what he's done, he signed a 5-year, $60 million extension, the same one that Horford signed. The day that he signed that extension, it was under market.
Yeah.
So, you know, on that contract, I think it's pretty safe to say he outperformed that contract. He made the All-Star team twice. He won Defensive Player of the Year. I think he was number 4 in MVP voting or something for that, the year that he won Defensive Player of the Year. Like, he legitimately was, you know, one of the best players in the league. So now, you know, he's going to be 31. He turns 31 next month. This is his last chance at getting a big contract, just, you know, because, you know, he's over 30 and because of, you know, the way his health history is, not only with the shoulder injury, but with the knee thing that he had last summer. He's already lost some of his athleticism. You can kind of see that in the way that he's been playing before the injury. So this is going to be his last shot at a big contract. I don't think he's really going to be interested in giving anybody a discount, especially not the Bulls, where there's nothing to indicate that he's not going to still be coming off the bench, because that's something that he's had to adjust to, because Fred Hoiberg has decided that, you know, first starting, you know, Gasol and Mirotić was going to be the move, and then now he's gone with Gibson and Gasol for the most part since then. But, you know, Noah, he hasn't made it into an issue, because, you know, Noah, however much of a, you know, decline he's had as a player, he's a team player. He's not going to make a problem out of coming off the bench, but you can just tell being around him, being around the team, he is not happy about it. And I don't think he's going to be willing to take a pay cut to come back to a situation where it's a coach that has already basically made him come off the bench for the first time since he became a rotation player.
And there's always a confluence with players that the teams that are willing to give them the most money are also the teams that are willing to give them a bigger role, because that's just the way it generally works out, unless a team is so desperate that they're willing to pay to fill something that isn't really a gap. But that just doesn't happen much in the NBA right now.
Right, but I mean, Noah's going to get paid this summer. I think that's pretty safe. I mean, what I know, like, he's coming off his shoulder surgery. It's not ideal. Wesley Matthews basically got a max. I don't know if it was quite the max, but he got a 4-year, $70 million deal, come off a torn Achilles. And I know Wesley Matthews is younger than Noah, but a torn Achilles is also significantly worse than either of the injuries that Noah has had in recent years.
And Matthews, while I think Matthews will get more than Noah will, Matthews got more than Noah will get, he wasn't all the way recovered from his injury.
No! And that's an injury. Like, okay, a shoulder injury, you know, Kevin Love had a way worse shoulder injury than what Noah just had. He's been fine. But, like, the torn Achilles, that's still one of the worst injuries. You know, Kobe never fully recovered, and I know he was a lot older. Brandon Jennings is still kind of feeling his way back. There's really not a history of guys who come back from a torn Achilles and are the same player that they were over a long period of time. Wesley Matthews still got a max, even knowing that. So I think Joe's going to be okay financially.
Yeah, so do I. And I think that it's kind of, it's I like the move from Noah to the other long-term bull that is dealing with injuries, which is Derrick Rose. And where do you, like, from a health perspective, where do you think he is now? And do you think the Bulls finally understand that they need to lower his minute threshold, at least during the regular season?
Well, here's the thing. He's been playing some, like, the first month and a half of the season or so, he was legitimately one of the worst players in the league. He was forcing everything. He couldn't finish at the rim. He was still taking terrible jump shots, still taking terrible three-pointers. Around the middle of December, a game against the Clippers, coming into the second half, he took the mask off. He had been wearing the mask for the first bit of the season because he had that facial injury during training camp. Since he took the mask off, I think he was shooting like 40% at the rim before he took the mask off, which is, like, you know, abysmally terrible. Like, there's no excuse for somebody, especially somebody who can't shoot like Rose, somebody whose entire game is based on attacking, and, like, that's his whole effectiveness, shooting that badly. Now, you know, since he took the mask off, and especially since Christmas, he's kind of up to, you know, high 50s, which is actually at least above league average in terms of how he's finishing at the rim. So, you know, he's been a lot better recently. He's been attacking. There's been a couple of games recently, the last one against the Heat, and then also the game against Cleveland on Saturday, where he was getting great looks, and he had a lot of shots that were just going in and out, and there's, you know, not a lot you can do about that. I still like a lot of the looks he was getting. So I think Rose has become, I mean, he's never going to be 2011 Rose again. Like, that's just, like, a thing people should stop even talking about, because that's just never happening again. He just is not that same athlete. He does not have the same explosiveness. He never will, but he has gotten back to where he's not a complete minus every time he's on the court, and that's a big step for him.
It is a big step, and the reason I'm saying that to lower his threshold is not because of the way he's played. It's because the goal with him, at least as long as the Bulls, let's say, make the playoffs, I think that's a fair kind of place to put the line.
I think they'll make the playoffs.
So do I. Is that he is the key beyond Jimmy Butler to how far they go, just because they don't have an effective replacement for him, and when he's doing things well, he adds so much to what makes their offense really hum and really, if you want to say, sing, if it ever gets to that level. And so for me, when you have a player like that who has an injury history, if you can afford to do it, you want to tone down the regular season just because you don't need it as much.
Right, I would agree with that, and, you know, again, yeah, I think if they had any kind of a viable backup point guard, it would be a lot easier to do this. But, you know, their backups are Kirk Heinrich, who actually has been playing pretty well, but he's not more than like a 10 or 15 minute a game player at this point. And then you've got, you know, Etuan Moore, who is injured now, and Aaron Brooks, who is one of the most inconsistent players in the league. He's, you know, there'll be random games where he goes off for 30, but for the most part, he's just kind of a gunner in the worst way. So, you know, they really need Rose to be something close to himself in the playoffs. So I definitely agree with you that they probably need to be watching him, especially because, like, lately he's been having these hamstring issues. He exited the Heat game on Monday early with a hamstring issue, just some tightness in the same knee that he had the meniscus surgery on last year. And yesterday at practice, Fred said he was still sore. So we don't know if he's going to play tomorrow against the Lakers.
And as Nate says a lot, hamstring issues in particular, you know, that kind of muscle stuff, that you just let it rest and you'll do a lot better. I mean, I can remember numerous times where people came back too early from hamstrings and re-injured it. I think David Lee did that. I think Lou Williams did that. There are a couple other guys recently that have.
Yeah, a lot of guys. That's something you don't want to play around with, especially for somebody with the injury history that Rose has had.
And speaking of injury history for Derrick Rose, we're not far enough to really know everything, but based on what you've seen so far, how would you compare Hoiberg to what you had before in Tom Thibodeau?
Okay, so there's a lot of levels to this. The biggest difference, I think, between Tibbs and Hoiberg is that Hoiberg is willing to let the younger guys play through their mistakes a little bit more. You know, he's stuck with Mirotic a lot of, you know, where Thibodeau would have probably just yanked him so fast. You know, he kept Tony Snell in the starting lineup. Not that he's had a lot of options, but, you know, he's given Bobby Portis minutes. Doug McDermott, I think, is the guy that you can just tell the most is so happy to not have Tibbs there anymore. But, I mean, now as far as dealing with him, like, from a media standpoint, Fred's a really nice guy. He doesn't really say that much, but he's willing to play the game a little bit more.
Yeah, that all makes sense with what I've seen. And the idea of letting young players play through it is fascinating with this team, because the Bulls have had young players kind of throughout this run, but giving them a little bit more leeway and a little bit more of a leash could really help them long term, because they have so much money the next 2 years in other guys that really the way that they can get better and the way they can become more dangerous is by having at least one of those guys break out.
Right, and, you know, you would see this kind of last year with, you know, Doug McDermott or with Tony Snell. You know, they would blow one defensive rotation, and Tibbs would just yank them for the rest of the game. And Hoiberg, I think, you know, he's kept a little bit of a tighter leash on Bobby Portis, but, you know, he's willing to let guys kind of shoot their way out of slumps and stuff like that now, which is something that Tibbs never really did.
Offensively, has it been, I know that there were expectations that it was going to be very different. Has it, and I know early in the season there was some disappointment that it was more similar than you thought it would be. Has that changed over the season?
A little bit, but here's the thing, like, it was never going to be a dramatic change this year. When you look at what the roster was, I think the Bulls front office kind of let their personal feelings about Tom Thibodeau, which that situation, having seen it up close, that was just as ugly as you read about it in the reports by the end of it. So, but they kind of let their personal feelings about Tibbs cloud their judgment about where this roster was at. And they thought that just changing out the coach and keeping everything else the same was going to have this kind of transformative effect on the team, the way that, you know, like the Warriors did when they got rid of Mark Jackson, brought in Steve Kerr, and basically kept the roster the same, maybe added one or two guys. This Bulls team, you know, Hoiberg's whole thing is he wants to run. He wants to play fast. He wants to play like a really ball movement heavy offense. This is just not a roster that can do that. You know, Pau Gasol is old and slow. Noah, before he was injured, is slow. Now, at this point, he didn't used to be, but he is now. Rose is still kind of feeling his way back from a lot of different injuries. There's just a lot of guys that just don't fit with the kind of offense that ideally Hoiberg wants to run. So I think what it's going to be is something a little bit more similar to what Stan Van Gundy had in Detroit, where it's not going to really be fair to judge the success of the system that he's trying to put in until the second year, because Stan comes in with this roster that just does not fit at all with the kind of style that he wants to play, where, you know, he has a lot of shooters around Drummond. But then, you know, he gets rid of Josh Smith. They let Greg Monroe walk. They bring in other guys that kind of complement him better. And now this year, you're kind of starting to see the results of that. I think the same thing is going to happen with Hoiberg, where next year, you know, Noah's going to be gone. Powell's going to be gone. They're going to have more young players. Portis, I think, is going to have a bigger role. If the Kings may finish outside of the top 10 in the lottery, they're going to have Bulls are going to have a lottery pick or like a low playoff pick from Sacramento plus their own pick. So it's going to be a pretty different roster. Plus, who knows what they'll do with Rose this summer. It's going to be a pretty different roster from what it was this year. So I think that's going to be when it's more fair to judge what Hoiberg is doing. But so far, you know, this is just not a roster that fits with what he wants to do. So the fact that it's been slow to develop in terms of the offense that he wants to run, you can't really blame him for that.
That's a great point, and there's a parallel with New Orleans, that New Orleans was a team that changed their coach, thought everything was going to do, but what made New Orleans' situation a lot more egregious than...
They just had literally everybody on their team is injured.
Yeah, but also, they had a lot of their guys in free agency, and they said, hey, we're still going to stay big. You know, we're going to pay Oshik, we're going to pay Ajinsa, we're going to do that. The Bulls were kind of prisoners in their own salary cap situation and their own contract obligations, which is fine. I mean, their team is better than New Orleans. You know, they have a lot of talent. But you're right that it is going to take another year. And I chuckled that you kind of buried in there about who knows what's going to happen with Derrick Rose. What are you feeling on that?
I don't know if they're going to trade him. I know that's something that the people have kind of floated around. It'll be easier to do it this summer because he's going to be expiring. So you're not going to have to talk somebody into taking back long-term money. And I was last week at shoot around before the Warriors game, I was having lunch with our mutual friend, Tim Bontemps from the Washington Post. And he brought up the idea of trading Rose to Brooklyn basically for cap relief because Brooklyn is going to be far enough under the cap that they can take him back. And he's actually an upgraded point guard for them. I do think that unless he's willing to take a big discount, which I don't think he will be, just because of his health history, and I think somebody's going to overpay him because the cap is going to be so even more inflated than it is next summer in 2017, I think that Derrick Rose most likely is not going to be in Chicago after his contract is up. Whether they trade him before then or not depends on who's willing to take him on. Because would you trade for Derrick Rose right now with his health history, with, you know, how inconsistent he's been, and with, you know, you have to pay him $20 million this year, $22 million next year? I wouldn't take him on if I was a team unless I was getting some asset back, and I don't think it's worth the Bulls giving up like Bobby Portis or a pick or something to get somebody to take the last year and a half of Rose's contract. But, you know, it's pretty clear at this point. This is Jimmy Butler's team now. And Rose long-term is not going to be the kind of player that they it's not going to be the level of player consistently that they want to keep around for the amount of money he's going to ask for, and I just think somebody else is going to offer him more money.
Yeah, and I think we'll get to it in a second, but the point for me about it being Jimmy Butler's team is what makes this super big, because if you think about this team through a Jimmy Butler lens, he's 26 right now, he'll turn 27 before next year, so he's probably either prime or getting really close to it. And then you think about, okay, so who on this team aligns with that? And the answer is a lot of players. McDermott, Mirotić, probably Taj Gibson, though he's, you know, a little bit older. Portis, of course. And so you kind of have all that. Snell, whenever they get the Kings pick, whoever they draft with their own pick. And so if you kind of say, okay, that's where we want to go, and also I would say that group aligns pretty well with what Hoiberg wants to do offensively. And just
Derrick Rose, by the way, is only 27.
Right, but he's a very old 27.
He's an old 27 just because he's had so many injuries he had to come back from. It basically. He has the knees of probably a 35-year-old at
right.
this point.
And so the real challenge this summer, you know, so like theoretically, if you were to trade Rose, and especially if you were going to give up an asset for it, because they're not going to be a tax team because it's hard enough for them to spend the money, is you're trading him to use the cap space sooner rather than later. And unless Kevin Durant wants to go there, which I doubt intuitively, but I don't know.
I would be shocked if they even got a meeting.
Exactly. So if he's not on the table, the only other guy maybe would be Al Horford, who, of course, is going to have a lot of offers, and he's a little bit older. I would say he doesn't line up perfectly from an age perspective. He lines up very well. Like, if he were your center, I think that would be awesome. Like, I think that would, you know, that would be a very good team a little bit sooner. But, again, realistically, you know, you have to be his number one in order to get him, because everybody's going to have the money to offer him whatever he wants. And so if I'm the Bulls in that case, then I'm not chomping at the bit to unload Derrick Rose now. However, the point that you talked about with Tim Bontemps, which I think is a very astute one, is a little bit different. And the idea there, and I actually have a piece, I don't know when it's coming out for the Sporting News, it'll be after this airs at some point, about the idea of there's going to be kind of a secondary or tertiary trade market for guys who are already under contract. And the reason for that is, we're going to see the insane money that is going to be paid out this summer.
But that's probably all going to happen. within the first couple days of free agency, everybody that's going to, you know, once the Durant domino falls, then, you know, Horford and Conley are the next two guys. And then after that, we're going to kind of see, I feel like, what, you know, what we saw the first week of free agency where all this money was flying around. And then after that, just because of the amount of jump that the cap is going to have, and also the amount of jump that the cap is going to have the following summer, like, teams are still going to have so much money left over even after every free agent that's worth paying or overpaying is gone.
Exactly. And so you're going to, so some team is going to be sitting there with space burning a hole in their pocket, and they're going to say, you know, would we rather have take a flyer on Derrick Rose at 1 year for 22, I think it's 22 million.
22, yeah.
22 million, or do something else? And somebody's going to say yes. The question at that point is going to be, what would the Bulls do with that flexibility? Because again, I don't think you're going to move him just for the sake of moving him, but if there's somebody they have in mind. But what they could do, and this is what I would recommend if Garpacks offer, if they asked me for my insight, would be approach the offseason like you're going to have some cap space, and some players won't be receptive to that. Some players are going to be like, well, we're not going to listen to you unless you have the space to sign it. And, you know, if the right person comes along, have the faith that you can move Rose if you have to. And that's the way that I would think about it. And if everybody says no to you, then that's fine. And you don't use that space. And if somebody says yes, then you start to make that work, which in a way is kind of what the Warriors did when they got on.
I was just going to say, yeah, because they didn't. They had to, you know, at the last minute, because they were supposedly trying to get Dwight Howard. They were, you know, at least got a meeting with him. And then in order to do that, they had to move the Richard Jefferson and Andres Biedrin's contracts to even make room for Iguodala. But they were able to do that. But they basically were able to sell Iguodala on, look, we want you. If you want to play for us, we'll figure out how to make the money work.
Yeah, and a lot of players aren't willing to do that. You know, that's, again, that will be a lingering thing. The piece I wrote on Kevin Durant, he would basically have to take him, if he took a meeting with the Warriors, it would have to be on that logic, because they're not going to say, hey, look, we have max space available right now. But some players will, and what's nice about being Chicago as opposed to certain other places is that it is a place that people are interested in playing. It's a hit friend.
You say that. Who's the biggest free agent the Bulls have ever gotten in franchise history?
Boozer, probably. In recent years, it's Boozer, isn't it?
Pau.
Oh, yeah, Pau, that's true.
Well, because, I mean, the Bulls, and I say this every time they go after one of these guys, the Bulls, like, are probably the best team in franchise history at being the runner-up to getting guys. Because, you know, they went hard after Carmelo Anthony a couple summers ago. He was choosing between the Bulls and the Knicks. He ended up staying in New York. A couple of years before that, like, before LeBron actually became a free agent, there was kind of this thought, I think Jonathan Abrams was reporting this back when he was with the New York Times, and other people were reporting that Chicago was actually the front runner to get LeBron and Bosch. They end up with Carlos Boozer. You know, years and years before that, they go hard after T-Mac the summer that he ends up leaving Toronto to go to Orlando. They don't get him. Like, they always go after these guys.
Kobe.
They almost traded for Kobe. I think that trade was done, except that Kobe vetoed it because he didn't want Luol Deng to be included because he wanted Luol Deng to still be there. But yeah, like, I think they tried to put an offer together for Kevin Garnett that same summer when the Timberwolves ended up trading him to the Celtics. Like, they're always, like, going after guys. I think even at one point last summer, they were one of the teams that was maybe, before LeBron went back to Cleveland and it became clear that he was going to be getting traded to Cleveland, I think they were one of the teams that was potentially interested in trading for Kevin Love. Like, they're always, like, going after these guys, but they never get these guys.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And, you know, that doesn't persist forever, but also, I think personally that when you think about this team as kind of refocusing eventually, not right now, but eventually around Jimmy Butler, I think they dodged a bullet with Carmelo, unless he would have taken a substantial pay cut to go to the Bulls.
See, I actually disagree. I think it would have been great if Carmelo had come here.
That's interesting. Well, I think that if you had him on the contract he has with the Knicks, that would be a little bit of a problem. But if he was taking less, But I just think that the offensive identity of that team would just be problematic long term.
Well, the thing is, you have to question is, let's assume that they get Carmelo and, like, Rose still has his injury stuff and Jimmy Butler ends up breaking out even anyway the way that he did last year. Now you have Carmelo Anthony and Jimmy Butler as your two wing guys. That's a hell of a lot better than what they have now.
That's true. But you also have, you know, 20 plus million tied into this guy. But as you said, you know, cap space for the Bulls isn't as valuable as everybody thinks it is.
Well, they also just, like, again, what else are they going to spend this money on? They're not going to, you know, having Carmelo Anthony, if he had stayed healthy last year and he had come to the Bulls, I think it would have been great. And I think, I know Tibbs isn't there now, but I think he would have bought into what Tibbs was doing, and maybe Tibbs would still be there.
Yeah, I also think that Melo's long-term position is power forward, and that's one thing that the Bulls already have a lot of guys, but that's not to say that they're...
They don't have a lot of guys that are long-term, though.
Okay? Yeah, and their guys aren't, you know, like Mirotić and all that, they aren't so good that you're sitting there going, oh, well, we can't block X player with Carmelo. Well,
they thought that Mirotić was going to be that good, and he just has not been.
Yeah, Portis is another guy who, of course, has the, you know, he has the expectations. We loved him at Summer League. What have you seen so far, and if you had to guess kind of his long-term, let's say like 2 years from now, what do you think his role is on, let's say, like a conference finals team?
I think he's a third big on a good team long-term. I don't know if he's necessarily a starter, but he's, you know, he's a guy that comes in, he doesn't take anything off the table. That's the thing I've always said about him. He can rebound, he can score around the basket, he can shoot. He's not a very good defender yet, but, I mean, he's a rookie. You're not really expecting any rookie big men to be good defenders unless it's, you know, Karl Anthony Towns, who's just, like, transcendent already at 19 years old or whatever. But I think he's going to get better on that. And even right now, he's not so bad that he's a complete liability out there. He's certainly better than Pau Gasol as a defender at this point. So I think he's going to be, you know, a lot of the stuff he's doing badly right now, like, a lot of times it just seems like he gets lost out there, but it all just seems like it's just rookie stuff. And I think he's... You know, just know, and also just like getting to know Bobby a little bit in the month and a half that he's been in Chicago, or 2 months, or whatever, however long the season has gone. He's such a worker. Like he's gonna get a lot better. So I think him being a third big on a contending team is not unrealistic.
And I don't know why this is, considering I was really high on Portis, but I always think of him as older than he is, which is always a good thing for a young guy. So he's 20, he'll turn 21 in a few weeks. Uh-huh. So he has plenty of room to get better. He also played, you know, he played in the SEC, so he can, you know, work up to competition, all that kind of stuff. Like, I think that you're right that I think the most likely outcome for him is that in a couple of years he's still the third big. But I think he has potential to become more than that. And what I like about him is something you said, that he doesn't take stuff away from the table. And why that's important is that his natural position is power forward. Right. So what you can do with him is, I would say, regardless if, you know, you could talk about the small ball revolution and all that kind of stuff, and I talk about it a lot, but you still, to me, want a center who can protect the rim. And what Portis brings is he brings a guy that makes sense with a lot of different centers. So, you know, if you can get, theoretically, like a Porzingis-style center, Portis will do fine next to him. If you can get a, you know... Hassan Whiteside, to give you cold night sweats. Hassan Whiteside, you get Hassan Whiteside, he can do well with that too. So I think that...
It's kind of the same thing as Taj Gibson, actually, because Taj is the one out of the Bulls' main bigs, like their actual rotation guys. You know, I don't think Portis is that at this point because he's a rookie, but like out of their other guys, Taj is the only one that can play with Pau, he can play with Noah, he can play with Mirotić. And I think, you know, he just has that same versatility, and that's something he's developed over time because his offensive game has improved so much over the years. And that's, you know, that's kind of what I could honestly see Portis as, like a Taj type, in terms of just being really versatile, being able to play in a lot of different kinds of lineups, like you said. That seems like the kind of player that he might be.
And unlike Taj, Portis came into the league at 20 as opposed to like 26.
Right. Yeah, Taj, it's hard to believe, like Taj is still on his rookie contract, or like his rookie extension. It's hard to believe he's almost 30 already.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that because he was at SC when I was at UCLA, and I just remember thinking, like, we were pretty close to the same age, and yet he was in college when I was, like, I think I was pretty deep in law school.
So it's I want to ask you something, actually, because this stuff is kind of up your alley. This is something I've thought about lately. Taj has 1 year left on his deal after this year, and I think he's making, like, 8.5 or 9 next year.
Yeah.
What do you think about the idea of doing, because they're going to have so much cap space, and I know Taj is the one that always gets brought up in trade rumors and all this stuff, but I think Taj is the one guy that they kind of can't afford to lose. What do you think about doing with him what Denver did with Gallinari and Chandler, where they did that renegotiating and extending thing with some of their cap space and gave him like a 3-year extension on top of next year?
I think it's a really good idea for the Bulls. The reasoning for it is sound in this case. So yeah, he is a little bit older. He'll turn 31 this summer. But what something that we've talked about just a little bit ago is that Chicago has these high hopes for their cap space, but it doesn't usually work out. So what I would do with Taj is I would make him an offer, and the big benefit of a renegotiate and extend, and Nate Duncan's written about this well before, and we didn't actually, I don't think when we've discussed it, we've ever used Taj Gibson, but he makes sense with this, is part of the reason you want to do a renegotiate and extend is that you're hopefully getting, you're getting the player to commit to less money long term because you're giving them a pay raise in the immediate.
That's right, why, right, right. Because they can go to him and say, look, we know that this deal that we signed you to a few years ago ended up being absurdly below market. So, you know, we recognize that you've outplayed the contract over the first 3 years of this contract. Now we want to give you, we want to keep you here long term. And so, you know, as a reward, you know, we're going to give you a little bit more on the front end.
Yes, like, let's say if I were to kind of conceive of how this would go, if it were me, I would say, okay, Taj, we really like you. What we'll do is we can raise your salary to about $13 million. So you're getting a raise of, let's say, $5 million. But from there, we want it to go 3 more years, and it will decrease a little bit each year. So then that way, if you're the Bulls, then you get a little bit more space. You're getting more flexibility than you would if you signed him to a regular deal, because they almost always escalate. So if you went, you know, let's say 13, 12 and a half, 12, 11 and a half. So then you're basically, what you're giving him is you're giving him 36, you're giving him about $41 million more money. So he's basically getting 3 years and $41 million, which is, I think, you know, he could probably get more than that, but it's not too bad. But
I think it's easier to sell him on that now that he's a starter. If he was still coming off the bench like he had been basically for his entire career, it might be a little bit of a harder sell for him to go to him and be like, hey, so, you know, we know you, we've been having you come off the bench in your career. And, you know, even though you've been basically good enough to be a starter on most teams, but, you know, hey, you want to take a little bit less money than you can probably get on the open market to stay around? Now that he's a starter, and it seems like he's going to be a starter for the foreseeable future, especially now that Noah is out and Hoiberg doesn't really have a lot of confidence in Mirotić or Portis yet, and Gasol is probably going to be gone next year, it'll be very easy to go to Taj and say, hey, you're going to be a starter if you sign this extension. And yeah, I think that might make it more likely that he would be willing to take it.
Yeah, I agree. And also, you know, pushing to something in that range, you know, his career earnings right now are less than $30 million. You know, he's pushing up right against that because his first 4 years, he made a combined like 5 or 6, and then, you know, his current contract gives him more than that, of course. So I think there's a possibility also he has to be looking at it saying if he waits all the way till free agency, he'll be 32 at that point. As a power forward who doesn't really play a lot of center, you know, obviously somebody's still going to spend a lot of money, and something that might work as a sales pitch for him, and that would be really fascinating if it did work, is the idea that it's going to be going into a lockout. So you get this financial security. Not only do you get more money before the potential lockout, but you have your contract already settled. So who knows where the league is going to go, but you're going to be locked in and you're going to be getting that money no matter what.
And it's an organization that, you know, for as many flaws as they have on a lot of levels, they're always contending. They're always at least in the playoffs. And I think Taj knows that, and I think he appreciates that, and I think he knows what he's got here.
Yeah, I think he knows what he has. And also, there's an idea that if at that kind of a price, he doesn't have to be thinking about it going, you know, kind of like, I don't know if Kobe thought about this when he signed his current extension, but the idea of when Kobe signed that, if I were his agent, one of the things I would have told him is, you know, hey, if you want to take this money, feel free, but the team around you is not going to be good. You know, like, if there's a certain level of money that if you take it, you are basically assuring that in the NBA with its soft cap, you're basically assuring that you can't add a lot of talent. Taj at 12, 13 million is not doing that at all.
No, I think, you know, having that contract, you know, especially once the cap goes up again in 2017, you know, that's going to look like as good of a deal as his current deal where he's making 8 or 8.5 or whatever he's making this year is right now.
And he's also in a place, something that I've put this before, I think I put it in the NBA Utopia. If not, it's something that I've thought about a lot, is I wish that the NBA had looser rules on who could get a no trade clause, because I feel like really, that doesn't... the only people that hurts, I've talked about this with Kevin Pelton, is the only people it hurts is when ownership changes over, which isn't the case in the Bulls. It's like...
That is not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, so like you kind of wish that they had laxer rules on no-trade clauses, because you'd be like, hey, if you want to stay here, then you can do that. So maybe you can sign him to a more affordable deal, and you give that as a trade-off, and you're not ever expecting to have to use it anyway.
Right, right. So, I mean, this is something, and again, we'll see if the front office is, you know, forward-thinking enough to do this. They haven't been known to be the most creative. I was actually shocked when they gave Jimmy the max qualifying offer to prevent him from signing, like, that short-term Chandler Parsons-type deal as a restricted free agent with another team. I was shocked that they even, like, had the foresight to do that, because this is not really a front office that's known for thinking outside the box on a lot of levels.
It was huge that they did, though, because that allowed them to lock him up, so.
Yeah.
So what is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you think is like a kind of a notable story for the Bulls that maybe people who aren't as close with this team might not be appreciating?
I don't know. I mean, this team is just kind of like they're so hard to get a read on. Like they'll beat Cleveland, and I know that was like right after the Blatt stuff happened, and that was Ty Lue's first game. But like if you look at the teams they've beaten this year, they beat Oklahoma City twice. They beat San Antonio. They've beaten Cleveland twice. And then they turn around and need overtime to come back from a 25-point deficit to the Sixers. And it's just like on a night-to-night basis, they could beat the best teams in the league and lose to the worst teams. I think their ceiling is they're going to be a first or second round out. I don't think they're as good. I mean, they're certainly not as talented as Cleveland, but they're not – I don't think they're as good as – Toronto or Atlanta or Miami either, but they're at least in that discussion just because kind of somebody has to be in that discussion. So I think there's a chance they could win. They could make the Eastern Finals just because somebody has to besides Cleveland, but I just don't. I mean, I think the Bulls just kind of are what they are, and the Noah injury really throws a wrench into what they could have maybe done at the trade deadline. Now I don't think they're going to do anything.
Yeah, I think what I'm feeling with them is that at best, I think they're the third best team because the Raptors have shown something to me recently.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you.
And I think the Hawks are a better regular season team than playoff team. That actually, a Hawks-Bulls playoff series would be one that I would really want to see. But so if I'm Chicago, it does kind of depend on how you'd classify success. But, you know, I would try to get either my goal would be kind of the 3 or the 6. Because if you're the 4 or 5, I just feel like your destiny is to win your first round series and then lose to the Cavs in 6 games. Like
right, if they aren't in that 4 or 5 bracket, I think they have a chance at making the conference finals.
Yeah, and so I think you try to do that a little bit, but at the same time, you know, you can't really finesse your standing until the very very end of the year. So you just kind of get what you can get. And I'm excited for the Bulls in the sense that this is the first time in a little while that they've had some mystery to them. I mean, before, they were in this boat where whatever you thought of them, you were pretty sure of it. And while that's kind of fine and it's, you know, it's interesting, like, it was what happened to them in the playoffs last year. You know, it felt to me like that was just what was going to happen. And I'm excited to have a team that has a lot more variability.
Not necessarily good variability, but variability nonetheless.
Yeah, exactly, and I just because that makes the league more interesting, and actually that might be the greatest story of the Eastern Conference so far this year is all of these teams just have a lot of variability. You know, you see even Atlanta. You know, Atlanta is doing better now, but their point guard situation is really in flux, and just everybody. You look at the East. I mean, Orlando was in the mix, and then now they're falling, and
Charlotte.
I think Charlotte's a little bit clearer. It's just they fell because their guys were hurt. But like, what excites me about the East is even with the Cavs to a point, like we just don't know what these teams are.
Right, and it's kind of like the East. Certainly, you know, the East is, you know, probably better 3 through 10 than the West, because obviously the two best teams in the league are the Spurs and the Warriors, and they're both in the West, but it might be kind of a reverse situation of the last couple of years where somebody, you know, the ninth seed in the East is going to have, you know, 42, 43 wins. And then the, you know, some team in the Sacramento or Portland or Denver or somebody is going to get into the playoffs in the eighth seed in the West with like 38 wins. Like it might be that.
Well, and you know how this hilariously works to Chicago's...
That's right, yeah, but the Sacramento pick.
Yeah, so Sacramento, it could either save or help the Bulls or bury them, because there's the possibility of what happened to the Sixers with Miami last year, which is that they were in a boat where either they were going to make the playoffs or they were going to be able to fall kind of right into the place where the protection, which that pick was top 10 protected. I don't think anybody thought that the West-East dynamic was going to shake out in a way that a Western Conference team would be able to make that choice. I think the expectation was that if you were on the playoff fringe of the West, you're going to be in that, you're either going to be picking 12 or you're going to be picking like 18. And instead, it's where the kind of where the East was last year. I think some of that will resolve with time. You think about teams like Utah, who has been explicitly really not healthy, and I think they're a lot better than their record. But at the same time, you know, you could see Dallas or Memphis or whoever else fall off a little bit. So yeah, I think it's really fun with the East also, because like you look at the West, and even the teams in kind of the middle, let's say Houston, like, I feel like with Houston, we kind of know what they are. It's just that we don't know what the record's going to be. But if you were to ask me, you know, like, how good is Miami? How good are the Celtics? I'd be saying, like, I could give you a very nebulous answer. And, like, that's not to say, like, I don't know their personnel. I know their personnel very well. But how it fits together. And also, I feel like the East, if they want to, depending on how these teams see themselves, the deadline could completely reform some of these teams if they're willing to do it.
Yeah, I think we're going to have kind of a weird... what do you think is going to happen with the trade deadline? I wonder if... Because last year, just everything was just bananas. So I wonder if there's going to be like that kind of a shakeup with some of these teams. I wonder if some of these Eastern Conference teams are going to see an opening with all this dysfunction that's going on with the Cavs, you know, a team like a Toronto or somebody, to be like, look, we can make a trade right now and go for it and try to set ourselves apart from this whole cluster of teams that are in that 2-10 pack in the East. Like, I feel like there's an opportunity for some team to make a trade and add somebody.
I think that Cleveland's recent uncertainty completely changes that. I think there was this idea that I think the market was going to be stalled because it's like, well, why should we push for guys? And so it was going to be more the equivalent of like when two people don't value an asset the same way. So like the comparison for that might be, I'm also thinking about this because both of their names were in the news today, of the Joe Johnson trade to the Nets, where basically the Nets wanted him more than Atlanta did, so they just made that trade. I think we'll see some of that. But now, with Cleveland being there, if you're probably the two teams would be Toronto and Atlanta, but if you're one of those teams saying, well, we might have a better chance now than we thought we did to get to the NBA Finals, I mean, you're probably not going to win the title, but I don't think Toronto really sees themselves in that, or like, I don't think Masai sees them as like a title contender in that same way.
Well, I just don't see how, even Cleveland, I don't see how anybody can realistically look at Golden State or San Antonio and say, yeah, we could beat them in a 7-game series.
Agreed. And also with Toronto, part of the reason why I say that about Masai is that when they gave Terrence Ross that contract, that took away some of their ability to just really aim high, you know, in that sense. Like, it was kind of like to really do something aggressive this summer. But, you know, now maybe they see that as a little bit more open, which would be hilarious because that's kind of how Toronto got in this boat in the first place, was by outperforming relative to expectations.
Well, they were ready to blow it up. And then once they traded Rudy Gay, their season just completely turned around a couple of years ago.
Right. And so then that, I mean, and there you could make an argument that, you know, that kind of changed their long-term trajectory. You could argue in a positive or a negative way. Obviously, it made them a reliable playoff team, which is wonderful. But, you know, kind of took away some of their ceiling just because they never bottomed out. But, I mean, I would take what they had. You know, this is something that I try to talk about a fair amount is, you know, you can define success a lot of different ways.
And they got Kyle Lowry on a great contract after they almost traded him to the Knicks.
Exactly. Like, so they ended up in a good spot. DeRozan has done wonderfully well for them, which is another incredibly complicated situation. But, yeah, I think that what we're going to see at the deadline is we're going to see a lot of teams hold pat. But what I've predicted already is that almost any team that commits to money for next season, basically that uses their cap flexibility now as opposed to in July, is going to be better for it. And because the idea is teams are going to, I think that, and this is what my piece is going to be on in a couple of days, is like, I don't think people understand how bad the contracts are going to be, just because every team is going to have money. So you're going to see, and the talent pool isn't that deep. So you're just
it's not. There's three guys. There's Durant, obviously, right at the top, and then the next two guys are Horford and Conley. And after that, there's a pretty steep drop off.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're DeMar DeRozan, you're just sitting there licking your chops because somebody's going to
get you. You know, I'd actually put DeRozan in that second category at this point.
Yeah, so would I. Yeah, I would have DeRozan there. And so
he's going to get a lot of money.
Harrison Barnes is going to get a lot of money. I think basically everybody is going to get a lot of money. So if you're a team and you're sitting there going, well, you know, we'd lose some flexibility now, but we could get X player. As long as they're reading the talent right, I would probably lean towards that team getting the better of the trade, because unless you are a major market, which is the other part of the dynamic for the summer, or you have some other thing that makes you really desirable, I think you're going to miss out on all the main guys. And even the restricted free agent class is interesting, but
Drummond's not going to go anywhere. Right?
Exactly. Like, who wants to? Why would you want to be the team that offers Drummond his contract unless you just want to foster goodwill with his agent? Because you're never going to get him.
You're never going to get him. You're probably not going to get Brad Beal.
Well, that's a little bit more interesting now. I don't think you are, because what are the
reasons going
to be with
Washington?
Neither do I. But I think that, yeah, and like Harrison Barnes, I've heard some people say that. It's like, you know, if you're the Warriors, and this is something that I've wanted to talk about a while, like, if you're the Warriors, even if you, let's say, you don't want him long-term on what would be a max deal for him, you match and then you trade him. Why would you ever let him go for nothing? It just doesn't make any sense, unless some team, for whatever reason, was insane enough to give you something in a sign-and-trade, but that's not what history has said. You know, in this CBA with a sign-and-trade, the best guy I can think of offhand that moved was Grievous Vasquez for Tyreek Evans. So you're not going to go from Grievous Vasquez to, like, a first-round pick, like a good first-round pick or something.
No, and then, you know, I think what might be interesting to see is, because there's going to be so many teams with cap space, some of the lower level restricted guys, somebody like Alan Crabb in Portland.
He's going to get so much money. Like, he might get 10 million.
That's a guy I feel like is going to, like, if you were a team with cap space to burn, that's a guy that, you know, you might want to, you know, you look at him and you say, you know, he's put up some good numbers on this Portland team that's not very good. Maybe try it. He's in his third year, so he's not going to be, you know, limited to the Gilbert Arenas provision. So you can offer him whatever you want, basically. And so that's a guy I would try to just give an offer sheet to, kind of like what the Blazers did, however many years ago with Wesley Matthews, where, you know, it was this young guy, he was kind of unproven still, and they were just like, we're going to do a contract that we think Utah won't match. And they ended up not matching, and it turned out to outperform that contract. So I think that's a guy. Like, I'm sure there are other guys that you can name more easily right now than I can. But, like, there are guys, like, in that class, like, younger guys who aren't as much known commodities as somebody like a Harrison Barnes or an Andre Drummond, who are going to be restricted free agents. And you want to just kind of see if you could, like, walk the line between giving them a contract that's not going to kill your cap but might be big enough that their team won't match it.
Yep, Tyler Johnson's another guy but he's subject to the Arenas provision. But the guy, I was thinking about this when you were talking about Alan Crabb, the guy who's going to be mad this whole summer is going to be Will Barton. Because Will Barton,
like, $3 million a year.
Yeah, he just signed at the, he just got really unlucky. I mean, he was disappointed.
He would probably get maxed out if he was a free agent this summer.
But yeah, even if he didn't get maxed out, I mean, he'd get 13, 14. You know, like, he would if he were a free agent, let's say his contract, for whatever reason, it mutually dissolved this summer, he would be getting more money per season than he signed for last summer.
I would agree with that.
That's insane. Like, you think about, like, how that could happen every once in a while, and kudos to the Nuggets for being able to pull that off. Like, but they better use that flexibility, because otherwise, like, while they have it, because you have a guy on that contract, this is something I can speak to as somebody who covers the Warriors with Stephen Curry, is, like, one of the big things that is a storyline in this league right now is when you have a competitive advantage like that, it will never last long term, and you have to use it while you have it. And the Warriors are one example. They've done a wonderful job of building a team around a great player who was horrendously underpaid. And the team that didn't do that is Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City had all of those guys super cheap, and they weren't willing to spend long term. They kind of saw the future and traded it away when they could have built what functionally could have been a super team.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, Steph Curry right now is making, what, like 10 or 11 million a year or 12 maybe?
Yeah, I think this year he's in the 11s and next year he'll be in the 12s. I could be imagining
right.
off.
But so then he's a free agent in 2017, and that's the year that the cap goes up even more. So he's going to probably get like 30 million a year at least.
And he'll be worth it every second of the
day. Well, I know, absolutely. But like, I'm saying, like, that's going to, you know, whether he's worth it or not, and he absolutely is, I agree with you, but, like, having to pay him that much money, even though he's worth that much money, having to pay him that much money as opposed to having him on your books for 11 or 12 million, that just limits so much of what you can do in terms of, like, getting other guys to come. And that's just, that's such a big part of how the Warriors have been able to build this team that's so deep and so talented and so versatile, is they have this guy who's this, you know, this transcendent talent who's just on this absurdly cheap contract that, by the way, at the time, people thought was too big of a contract for him because they didn't know if his ankles were going to hold up.
Yeah, and that's something that has been lost in the shuffle just over the years, and if you want to call it hindsight bias, I think that's a fair way of classifying it, is that people don't remember that deal. Like, I think what I said at the time was it was a fair deal for both sides, because for Curry, it was risk mitigation. You know, it was the idea of, you know, the way you think about your first big contract is very different than the way you think about your second. And even though he comes from a family that, you know, his dad was an NBA player and all that, it's hard to turn down in the old CBA, in like the old times, it's hard to turn down $11 million a year when you have the uncertainty he has. And if you're the Warriors, you know, he was the shining light of the future, but, you know, you worried about whether he was going to be what Derrick Rose is now, where he's good when he's on the floor, but he's not on the floor very often. And the other insane part about that is that part of the reason Curry has maintained this rep is because the Warriors elected to shut him down early one year, which kind of led to everybody thinking he wasn't durable when he probably could have played through it a little bit
more.
Right,
but the whole reason that they did that was because they had to keep their pick, which ended up getting them Harrison Barnes.
Right, who is an important player on it. It's this whole kind of amazing thing that happened. But at the same time, you know, that deal was, anybody who says like, oh, Curry, you know, he swindled himself or anything like that, they're using hindsight. You know, that was not what
anybody... Well, I remember at the time, there was, I mean, I was kind of with you when Steph signed that contract. I kind of thought, yeah, you know, this is probably fair just because, like, the concerns about his health were real. But there was definitely a discussion about whether that was too much. And by the way, speaking of the Warriors, Luke Walton is not going to be coaching the All-Star team. I just got the email from the league that said that Popovich is going to.
Oh, I'm sure Popovich is thrilled.
Yeah. See, that, I think they should just let Walton do it, because, like, I mean, Kerr can't because he did it last year. Popovich clearly doesn't want to. He's talked openly about how much he hates doing it. Pop would be happy to let Luke Walton do it. And I just think it would be really funny if we had all-star teams that were coached by one guy who was an interim coach while the coach was out with a back injury, and the other one who just replaced a guy who got fired on the team with the best record in the Eastern Conference.
No, I agree. I think that's a cool idea. The one that I like better is you have Luke Walton coach the East, and you have David Black coach the West.
Coach the West?
Yes.
So you have them switch sides.
Because you can't have David Black coach the East for kind of obvious reasons.
Well,
so
that would be amazing, actually, because you would have, you know, he would try to take LeBron out, and LeBron would be like, no, I'm checking myself back in, or like he'd try to draw up a play, like, because you know how in the All-Star game in the fourth quarter, LeBron, or like it basically turns into a dunk exhibition, you know, David Black, you know, calls a timeout and tries to draw up a play to get, like, Andre Drummond, you know, a breakaway dunk or something, and LeBron's just like, no, we're running this for me.
It would be hilarious. Like, I've thought about before about if Blatt, because they're playing a smaller lineup of just who ended up starting at the East. If
right.
Blatt ended up coaching it, he makes LeBron do the jump ball and then immediately pulls him and then just sits him the rest of the game. Just like, that would be the greatest form of petty vengeance.
That would be hilarious. Like, the All-Star game is so, like, nobody actually watches the All-Star game as much as we make a big deal out of, you know, who makes it and who doesn't. Nobody actually watches the All-Star game. I can't really, the only thing I can remember from any All-Star game is that time, like, maybe 3 years ago when Kobe blocked LeBron, and that was, like, a big deal for narrative reasons or whatever. That's the only thing I can actually remember from an All-Star game.
So T-Mac throwing the alley-oop to himself, I remember that.
That's right, yeah, that was...
T-Mac did that. Dirk did something funny last year, I think he got
Noah, like, 2 years ago, had a couple of hilarious plays in an All-Star game.
Yeah, I remember more of the rookie-sophomore game than I remember the All-Star game, and part of that is because there is this fundamental issue that I understand why they do it, because the Pro Bowl is unwatchable too. But having a mid-season All-Star game, the game itself is always going to be terrible because the players don't want to get hurt.
Right, and especially, you know, somebody like Carmelo Anthony, he only did it because it was his, it was in New York, but like so many guys, like, why is LeBron, I know LeBron obviously is going to get voted in as a starter basically for the rest of his career and all this stuff, but like, LeBron has so many miles on him, why is he going to go hard at the All-Star game? Honestly, except for the fact that it would, you know, for like petty reasons, he wouldn't be okay with it. I'm sure LeBron would actually be fine with that if David Blatt pulled him right away in the All-Star game, because then he wouldn't have to put those miles on it for a meaningless exhibition game.
Yeah, what they should do is they should have the first three quarters be primarily played by the guys who are under contract for multiple years who actually care. You know, like, so give Jimmy Butler...
Like the first time, guys, like Kawhi Leonard, like let Kawhi Leonard run wild.
Yeah, Kawhi, like Paul George, you know, all those type of Draymond.
If Isaiah Thomas makes it, then
Draymond Green. Like, just have those, you know, like, pick the guys on your team who actually care and have the most to play for, and just be like, okay, you guys get the first half.
And then the second half, you just have, like, you know, LeBron and Kobe and whoever just come out and, like, basically just take turns, you know, taking circus shots.
Yeah, or you give those guys the first, you know, you give the stars the first 8 minutes, and then you let the other guys run for a while. Like, whatever, just you don't understand the limitations and the positives of the medium and use that to your advantage, as opposed to now where you just kind of get this lax garbage for all but the last 5 minutes if it's close.
Right.
But the rest of All-Star Weekend is all right. I still think there are ways they could do it better. But
they're doing the USA versus the world thing again for the rookie-sophomore game, and I think they're going to announce the starters or announce the rosters for that today.
Oh, really?
But the world team, yeah, I think they're going to, like, today or sometime this week, but the world team is just going to destroy the U.S. team.
The world team's big men are going to be amazing.
Because you've got, I mean, Towns is Dominican, technically, so he might be on the world team.
He should be.
So you've got Towns and Porzingis together. Plus, like, if Nurkic is healthy, then you're going to have Nurkic in there.
Wiggins. There are a lot of guys.
So many guys.
Yeah, I mean, you could go in, and I mean, yeah, their guards are going to be a little bit shaky, but they should also just let Giannis play just out of, like, basically any guy who's really entertaining who did not make the All-Star game should just be allowed to be in whatever other things they want to be in.
Right, no, I'm totally with you.
Also, Boban has to be in the rookie sophomore
game. Boban should be in the All-Star game, honestly. You want to talk about making the All-Star game entertaining, there should be one spot, add a 13th spot to the roster for somebody who's, like, a fan favorite who just, like... Because, like, no, in the East, they could put Bruno or Bebe in there. As just kind
or
of
your, Giannis.
Well, no, because it's in Toronto, they probably want to have Bruno in there.
Yeah.
As like your token 13th man. Or somebody like Boban, or just like, you know, if Scalabrine was still in the league, you would want to have somebody like him in there just like as your, or like if Kent Bazemore is actually a player now, but back in the first 2 years of his career when he wasn't actually a player and he was just the guy with the crazy bench celebrations, you have him or like Bob Sacre just like be, you actually have like a mascot spot on the thing.
Or even you can use that spot for a mascot, or you can use it for like a legend type guy, and that spot
that would get around the whole Kobe thing, or like next year they might want to do the same thing with Kevin Garnett or Tim Duncan or Dirk, or if any of those guys like announces that they're going to be retiring.
Yeah, and so I think that one of the structural limitations of the All-Star game right now is that they haven't understood that it's an exhibition, and so also the rosters are way too small because, like, the league is big, and, you know, who is hurt by the rosters being a little bit bigger? I mean, and also...
There are 15 players on an NBA roster. There's only 12 on the All-Star roster.
Yeah, exactly. It's and there, you know, there are more than 12 teams in each league, so you can't even do the whole baseball garbage about how every team has to have a player. I'm not saying the All-Star game should do that. It absolutely should not. But you should at least have enough guys on your roster, especially considering that's 15 and 15 right now, that you could theoretically, you know, like, get close to that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and also, yeah, that would open it up. And for me, I mean, there's also the idea of if you want something to be a celebration of the game and an exhibition, that's fine, but then don't have it count for contracts. you know, like for the Rose Rule and everything else.
And don't make it be like a thing that we talk about when it's like comes time for like somebody's Hall of Fame case.
Exactly. So you embrace it being one way or the other way. And I think the only way to do it is as a showcase for the game. The other crazy idea like that I've had is I feel that one spot in the dunk contest should be straight. You have to submit yourself. So like it's not like you can submit anybody. But that one of the spots in the dunk contest can be fan voted, and it does not have to be somebody in the NBA. So the original idea of when I pitched this was for Andrew Wiggins when he was at Kansas could be in the dunk
contest. Well, the best, I think a way around that, and I think there's so many logistical hurdles with that in terms of like getting the NCAA to clear it and all this other stuff. But I like the idea of having the winner. Because I think they do the D-League dunk contest at some other point over All-Star Weekend.
I think it's the day before.
Right. Have whoever wins the D-League dunk contest gets to be in the NBA dunk contest.
Yeah, I completely support that as well. Yeah, I also think you widen the pool for the first round, and then, you know, if you need to narrow it after that, that's fine. You know, so if you have 8 guys competing for 3 slots, who cares? That's better than having 6, because especially if there are people who really want it. But yeah, so I was thinking about that. The other guy, because I will hold bitterness for the rest of my life, that prime James White never got to compete in an NBA dunk contest because...
Right, he did. He got to do it one time when he was, like, 35.
Yeah, I mean, but 20...
Year. And it was stupid. Like, all he did was, like, he had, like, a person become like a fake like air traffic controller, and then he just did a normal dunk. It was stupid.
Yeah, prime James White could go between the legs from the free throw line, and that would just break everything. And you know, to have a guy like that who just was slightly below NBA caliber at that time, to just have that as a celebration of like, look what we can do. And I'm not saying, you know, to get in all the N1 stuff, though I am not opposed to that too. Just like, look at the awesome stuff that this sport can do. And I think
they have to let Jonathan Simmons do the dunk contest, right?
I haven't seen too much of him doing it, but he has the physical ability that it wouldn't surprise me.
He had some pretty nice ones in Summer League.
Yeah, he did.
So, like, do we know, like, who do we think is going to, because Wiggins has already said he doesn't want to do it. I thought there was maybe a chance that they would kind of force him into it because it's in Toronto, but he has been pretty clear that he doesn't want to do it. I would assume LaVine is going to do it again.
I would assume LaVine will do it until he dies. Aaron
Gordon I would really like to see do it.
Gordon, yeah, it's always hard for big men because they even when they're good, they don't look good unless they dunk over the hood of a car.
I think Aaron Gordon could do some cool stuff.
Oh, I do too. I'm a big supporter. I'd have to think about it a little bit, but yeah, they would have a good group to do it. I'm trying to think. There was a big guy that I thought of recently would be really interesting in it, but I can't remember who it was.
Have Boban do it.
Oh. Yeah, well, he can basically dunk without jumping. I suggested that a couple days ago, that they should do a separate dunk contest for guys who can dunk without jumping.
Get Porzingis in there, like Rudy Gobert, Giannis.
Yeah, I've never said this on the podcast before. I've said it to people privately. If I could add one thing to All-Star Weekend, it would be the one question that every basketball writer has wondered, and it's two different things that are connected. One, a straight foot race end-to-end, and two, a foot race dribbling a basketball from end-to-end. And then we can just settle all these stupid arguments and just have it done.
Here's my other thing about All-Star Weekend. And I've talked about this, I think, other places before, but the celebrity game should not have WNBA players in it.
Absolutely not.
I think that's disrespectful to the WNBA players. I think I'm all about the NBA finding a way to feature the WNBA as something that, like, because I think the league has not done a very good job of promoting the WNBA as something that's more than a niche thing, which I think it should be promoted as something that people actually should care about. But I think a fun thing, like, instead of, now that, especially now that they got rid of that stupid shooting stars thing that the WNBA players always would do, where you would, like, do the half-court heaves, I think they're not doing that this year. But instead of just having, like, Elena Deladon and Maya Moore be in the celebrity game, do a 3-on-3 tournament of like, or a 3-on-3 game of like WNBA All-Stars. I think that would be a lot of fun, and I think that would kind of be a better way to showcase them to the fans. I think it's selling them short to put them in the celebrity game and say, okay, Elena Deladon, you're probably the best women's basketball player in the world right now. You're going to play on a team with Kevin Hart and Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that's an amazing point. I've also wanted some sort of a 2-on-2 or 3-on-3 tournament.
That would be a way that you could do that, and like, you could do that without having to, like, make the NBA guys do extra stuff and also get the WNBA players in there in, like, a kind of a unique format that people might actually get excited about.
And you now with the NBA, like they have some, they have networks that can show stuff. Like they can do things at the same time in different places. You know, like they have the D League All Star Game at a different arena.
You can just throw that on NBA TV or something.
Yeah, just put it on one of the other networks, and you can, and people will watch it. Make sure you promote it everywhere, and you don't even have to put it on one of the lower networks. You can just put it on a higher one during a different time.
Because well, they do that because they show the. On the Friday night, like, they show the rookie-sophomore game on TNT, and then the celebrity game is on ESPN at the same time. Like, so they have the rights, and then, you know, ESPN has a million channels. Like, even if they want to just, like, if they have other stuff going on that night, they want to throw it on, like, ESPNU or ESPN Classic or something. Like,
yeah, I think it'd be great.
There are ways to do that.
Yeah, and I think it would be a great showcase for them. I think it would be a more enjoyable basketball product for sure than the celebrity game, probably than the rookie sophomore game, though the rookie sophomore game gave us Brandon Knight getting just demolished that time, which was spectacular.
I gotta be honest, I've been to All-Star the last 2 years. I'm going to Toronto again next month. I have, both times I've been there, I have not gone to the rookie sophomore game.
I covered the All-Star game the year it was in L.A., and I actually loved the rookie-sophomore game just because it was so surreal, and I appreciate that, but as a basketball exhibition, it is terrible.
Right, I mean, that's the thing, like, if I don't have something else to do, but that's the night, the first year I went, I was in New Orleans, and I was able to get into the four-bar Friday rap battle that Damian Lillard held at a club.
Oh, yeah, I'd go to that. I'd go to that over the rookie-sophomore game.
And in order to go to that, I had to skip the rookie-sophomore game.
That is an excellent decision.
So that's the kind of thing. Like, I probably wouldn't skip the dunk contest, like the Saturday night stuff or something like that, or certainly not the game, because that's, you know, where you get the access to all the guys that you actually want to do. But if it's a choice between doing something cool like that or going to the rookie-sophomore game, I'm usually going to pick the other thing.
That is totally justifiable.
By the way, if anybody, you have a lot of people listening to this podcast, if anybody is in Toronto and knows a way to get me into the Space Jam live reading that the Toronto International Film Festival is putting on, could you contact me about that? Because I tried to buy tickets this morning, but it was already sold out because they let TIFF members buy tickets before the public, and they bought them all.
I will encourage them to reach out to you, and of course, when we finish this, you will have Sean's Twitter handle if you don't already follow him, which almost everybody does.
I'm almost at 14,000 followers.
Look at you, man. Anything else you want to talk about?
Not really. This was kind of it. This was good. You're not going to go to Toronto, are you?
I am not. There are a lot of things that I enjoy about All-Star, but it would be an interesting thing to talk about a little bit. So, like, for me, now I've had kind of different media experiences. I've done All-Star kind of once as media, once as media adjacent. And then I've done the draft, I've done the finals. And for me, and now having covered the finals, that was so much better for me than All-Star was, because the access to players is, you know, better, but the basketball is so much better. And, you know, the people who surround the finals, it's just a better experience.
Right. You don't have as many, like, because, I mean, with the media stuff at All-Star is so, like, especially the general availability is so worthless because, like, you know, I cover the Bulls, so, like, the two guys that were there last year from the Bulls were Powell and Jimmy. And you couldn't even get within, like, 15 feet of Powell because there was so much Spanish media there. And then, you know, you always have, like, people from, you know, the media from other countries just, like, going up to, you know, taking up the time and going up to, you know, whichever player and saying, hey, can you say hello to your fans in Belgium or whatever? And so there's so much more of, like, that kind of stuff at All-Star, which is fine. Like, again, like, there's going to be time, there's a time and a place for that. And I think All-Star is probably it. But, like, I agree with you. I think the finals are the best, you know, experience. This was my first year doing it this year in Oakland and in Cleveland. I really enjoyed doing that. I've never done the draft. I really have no desire to do the draft.
Yeah, what I would say with the draft is if there's a year that you really have a connection with the players, then it's fun to do once. It's a really weird experience to be there. For me, it was crazy because the year that I did it was 2012, which ended up being so important to the Warriors because that was the year they drafted Harrison Barnes, Festus Ezeli, and Draymond Green, who are a big part of the core of their title team. But what the All-Star story that I have ties in with you specifically, even though you weren't there, is so the draft, the All-Star I covered was earlier. It was in L.A. It was the year Blake Griffin dunked over the car. I'm giving myself air quotes because he dunked over the hood, which does not count in my opinion.
JaVale was robbed in that dunk.
JaVale was robbed. So the way scrums worked then, I think it's the same now, was they had one whole conference was out. So that was the 2010, 2011, I believe.
That was LA, right?
Yeah. So they put out the entire conference at one time. And so you could go to whoever. And so Kevin Garnett was getting, in the Eastern Conference, Kevin Garnett was getting mobbed. A bunch of other guys were, LeBron, of course, had, but you couldn't even get in with LeBron. The guy who had nobody was Derrick Rose. So I had it's a 5 or 6 minute conversation. Just
that was
Derrick
Rose. That was the MVP year. Too.
And then he won the MVP. So I had this conversation one-on-one with Derrick Rose, and we talked about, kind of his identity, where he saw himself going in the league. It's really depressing, actually, now, because we talked a lot about how, he wanted to develop a post game because he had all these he had physical advantages on the guys who play point guard. And so, I've been thinking about that kind of for the rest of his career after he won the MVP. It's like, that's what he wants to do. And then with everything that happened to him, he never really got the chance to go in that the way he wanted to. But yeah, so it was like every once in a while that can work out. So I had this long conversation.
Derrick is great to talk to when they let him.
Fabulous.
Which they never do anymore.
Yeah.
He's so guarded at this point because he knows that anything he says that can be sort of misconstrued as controversial is going to become a thing for like a week. But when he's actually in a mood, one of the best media experiences I've had was, because do you remember last year, right after the non-indictment for the officer that choked Eric Garner came down, he wore the I Can't Breathe shirt, and he was like and then like LeBron did it and Kobe did it.
He was the first guy.
Rose was the first guy to do it, and he didn't talk after the game that night, because I think he didn't play well. I forget what game that even was, but like he didn't play very well in that game, so he just kind of left before they opened up the locker room. But the next day at practice, he just talked for like 10 minutes just about like why he wore the shirt, and now that he has a kid, like what that kind of stuff means to him, and all this, he was so thoughtful, and it was so good.
The other guy that I had that with, which again was about opportunity, was the same basic story of how everybody else was Klay Thompson. And I went, when Klay, it was between his, was right before his second year, we had a 6 minute conversation about where he wanted to go as a player. And there's a big group of guys that are really good in that kind of a circumstance, but it just doesn't happen because the way that the media crush exists is that you don't really get those opportunities. And some other writers get it more often because they're feature writers. I mean, people like Lee Jenkins and Golliver and all that, and Abrams, of course, because they're unbelievably good at what they do. But something that does get lost in the shuffle, and I'm hoping that kind of the podcast world can open this up for some people, including Reddick's, which was going to happen at some point in the near future, is that there's a group of players, there's a pretty sizable group, that are really good in that format that just don't get the opportunity to show it.
Right, and that kind of stuff never really, translates. I mean, sometimes, the most talented feature writers, guys like Lee Jenkins and Chris Ballard and Jonathan Abrams and, guys like that, can make, somebody's personality really translate on a written piece. I still haven't read the thing that Lee just came out with about Porzingis. I'm probably, as soon as we're done doing this, I'm going to read that because I'm really looking forward to that. But, it's so much, since Woj has started doing his podcast, for the last couple of months, and he's had players on. He had, he had Reggie Jackson on. He had Isaiah Thomas on. He had Kyrie Irving on. And just, listening to those guys talk, it's a lot different from just, reading, them in quotes mixed in with, some writing. Just being able to listen to them talk and, share their perspective about, their careers and how they came up and stuff. That stuff is so worthwhile to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Sean Hyken for taking the time to come on. You can read him at Bleacher Report and NBC's Pro Basketball Talk, and you can also follow him on Twitter at Hyken, H-I-G-H-K-I-N. You can also follow his Facebook page, which is a nice way to keep track of all of his work as somebody who writes for multiple outlets, and that's Sean Hyken NBA, S-E-A-N-H-I-G-H-K-I-N NBA. All those links should be in the podcast. If you listen to it on Block Talk Radio on Real GM, the links will be there with his material and how to get it. And I love talking with Sean. He was actually my roommate for the Cleveland part of the finals, which was really fun. Got to know him a little bit better. And his perspective on the Bulls is, of course, important, but I love talking with him about larger issues. For those of you who enjoyed this conversation and haven't listened to it, I believe it was the Central Division capsule podcast over the summer with Sean and Brian Schroeder. We ended up talking about jerseys for like half an hour, and that was a lot of fun with both of them because they're super knowledgeable and about that and care about it like I do. So it was great to talk to him. I find the Bulls in a legitimately fascinating situation for the reasons we talked about. They have a cap situation. They're trying to figure out really what their future is, but they're good right now. And those are the teams that I find most compelling, are the teams that have to balance these different issues and have a high ceiling, but also have an interesting present. And so the Bulls are certainly in that conversation. There's about 3 weeks until the real decisions have to be made on that. And, you know, if they make it to the summer with largely the same roster, they're going to have a really complicated summer because Noah and Gasol have the choice to go wherever they want without compensation. I expect that they will do that if they want to, and we'll really see. I mean, I've been wrong a lot. I'll be wrong more, but I try to be right when I can. So thank you so much for listening. If you have any insight, you can send it to me on Twitter at Danny LaRoux, DannyLeroux, or you can email me DannyLaRouxNBA@gmail.com. I have that set up. As I always say, I try to read everything. I respond to as much as I can. I make no promises. It depends on the week. This week in particular has been insanely busy. So I do try to read it though. So, and I have had some really nice conversations with people on there. And if there's somebody that you want to have on the show, let me know. You can let them know as well. Don't flood their inbox or TL, but you know, if you want to mention it, you can, because it just gets it in their mind, as not many people say no anymore, but it's always nice. And yeah, it's been a fun little stretch for me. Still have a lot going on. The Warriors are about to go on a little bit of a road trip, so I'll have some more time to do some podcasting work. We'll really see what happens with that. But thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.